Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Come on, do it. What are you waiting for? Listen to Patrick Madrid.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Do it. Do it. Come on. Come on. Come on. Do it now.
And he wants us to do what? To listen?
Come on. Do it. What are you waiting for? Listen to Patrick Madrid.
Hey, by the way, welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Not everybody who listens, Cyrus, is necessarily pleased.
What? Oh, we're having fun.
It's Taco Tuesday, after
all. Yeah.
I got a nasty gram from somebody named Manuel on Twitter who says, Patrick, don't you think that Taco Tuesday rap song you love so much others might find racially offensive? No, I don't. Insensitive attitudes like yours is what causes many to believe in systematic racism. I think he means systemic. Is what causes many people to believe in systematic racism by those who might be clueless or malicious.
Oh, this guy just doesn't He doesn't like tacos, man.
I like tacos.
I don't know if he likes tacos or not, but sir, lighten up. Could you please just lighten up? To answer your question, I do not think that the Taco Tuesday rap song that I love so much is racially offensive. And by the way, I'm half Mexican. Not that that matters one way or the other. 100% on my father's side. And I don't think so. And I think you are being too touchy, too nitpicky, and overly sensitive. Let me hear that song again, Cyrus.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans on the plato.
This is good.
Patrick Madrid is on
Taco Tuesday,
coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
Taco Tuesday's my favorite day. That's the reason why I'm more awake. Better I don't care, homie, let them hate. I'm just trying to eat another plate.
Let them hate, Cyrus. Let them hate. Oh, by the way, you can kill the song now. By the way, sir. The gentleman who sent me the note on Twitter, you're going to have to take up your argument with all the Mexican guys who did the song. You're going to have to explain to them that they are being racially offensive and insensitive, and they're causing systemic racism. Take it up with them, because that's a video and a song that was produced by Mexican guys who love tacos. I happen to be one of those guys, although I had no part in the song. So,
I don't get it. So, what are you supposed to be playing? Like, should I find like the most boring? Since I'm the one pushing the buttons for the music, should I find the most boring white?
No,
like white music. I just don't understand.
No, it's just I look at it this way. I mean, I'm sure that this guy Manuel is probably a fine guy, you know, but people have become so delicate and so hair trigger ready to assume that any little thing is going to be racist. Come on, lighten up. It's not racist. It's not insensitive. It's not offensive. It's a funny song made by Mexican guys. Okay? I don't think we need to spend any more time on this. It's just a silly argument, if you ask me.
Here, this is... We'll make
what
this,
is this?
I don't know. Just
what
some,
is this?
Some music that's really not offensive to anybody.
Could you imagine if we did Taco Tuesday, this is our music?
Boring.
Yeah. Now, I do want to talk... This is actually an interesting segue. I do want to talk about an actual form of racism. And racism, of course, is wrong and reprehensible and should be denounced. I mean, I'm talking about real racism, not something that somebody, you know, takes an offense to. But in any case, this is a real story reported by the New York Times. A new law in Illinois will allow homeowners to change their housing deeds to remove racist clauses that were used to bar people of certain races and religious groups from buying homes or living in a particular neighborhood. The clauses, which are known as racial restrictive covenants, were outlawed under the Fair Housing Act in 1968, but they remain buried in an unknown number of property documents across the United States, relics of a broader effort by the real estate industry, federal housing authorities, and individual homeowners to prevent integration. In many states, it can be arduous, if not impossible, to remove the covenants from property records, prompting states such as Illinois to pass laws that streamline the process. As of January the 1st, homeowners in the state can submit a request to their county recorder to remove the covenants. The cost per request is capped at $10. Since 2018, at least 13 states have passed laws to make it easier to remove racial covenants from deeds. I think this is great. In fact, I don't think they should charge people anything to do it. I mean, that's a burden that the state should bear. Because after all, it's, you know, the state permitted it in the first place. But I'd be willing to spend $10 on that. Absolutely. There's another bill similar to this one that's pending in the New York State Legislature. One of the first people to request the modification in Illinois was Nicole Sullivan, who has been trying to change her deed since around 2011 when she bought a house in Lake County in the northeastern corner of the state. Her homeowners association sent her a copy of the deed dated March 1929 to explain why she could not create a fenced-off area for her dog on the property. She was intrigued by the document and then alarmed when she found a clause stipulating that the house could never be sold to or occupied by. Now, this is a direct quote from the deed from March 1929. Could never be sold to or occupied by, quote, any person or persons of the African or Negro, Japanese, Chinese, Jewish, or Hebrew races. What? Or their descendants.
Whoa.
Right there in black and white. Ms. Sullivan, who is white and a neighbor, tried to have the language removed but kept hitting roadblocks. Eventually, they approached the state representative, quoted here, who, with another state senator, sponsored legislation to allow these changes. Ms. Sullivan, 41 years old, said that the law change was largely a symbolic victory and that there was much more to do to improve housing equity in her community and across the United States, but she hoped that the law would help her make her neighborhood more diverse. She says, we're stopping the cycle of recycling this language back into our community, so no longer will new community members interested in putting up a fence have to read about how their ancestors would not have been allowed to live here. A study by Lake Forest College in Lake Forest, Illinois, found that by the late 1940s, more than 220 subdivisions in Cook County had created or adopted racial restrictive covenants. This subdivision is restricted to use by persons of the Caucasian race, read an agreement recorded in September 1946. This restriction shall not apply to domestic servants. I mean, there's more, but I think you get the idea, right? I mean, this is madness. And I'm so happy to see that this is being addressed, and I'm glad to see that this is being eradicated, even though it's long, long overdue. But I'm happy to see it taking place. Isn't that amazing, Cyrus, to imagine that that's what the world was like not that long ago?
That is not that long ago. That's disheartening. I mean, I'm glad it's changed, but how is this still on the books?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just imagine the fevered minds of the people who wrote those laws. I mean, somebody sat down at a typewriter and wrote that out because it came from his or her own mind, and it was voted upon, and it was approved, and it was introduced legally into these deeds. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to comprehend that type of racism would be so blatant and so widely accepted.
Does not apply to domestic servants. Whoa.
That's the loophole. Yeah, it's terrible, but I'm happy to report on that story, and I hope, to the extent that there are other similar racist relics of the past, that those too can be, you know, brought to light and then eliminated, please God. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Rhode Island and talk to Daniel. Hello, Hi, Daniel.
How you doing? Yeah, I just wanted to call because I heard the last caller and his sort of dilemma about, you know, whether to put the child in a Catholic school or homeschool. And I just wanted to say, I'm 58 years old. I have 4 children of my own and 14 grandchildren. I am a public school teacher. I've been doing it for 22 years in the state of Massachusetts. And I homeschooled all of our children, although I wasn't really the main homeschooler. It was my spouse, my wife. It is far a better option for many, many people. People need to not be afraid of this idea of socialization being a concern. Is probably the biggest lie about homeschooling that the left has propagated for decades, that your child, you know, perhaps won't socialize well. And it's just the opposite. Every one of our kids and now it's gone on. God's grown it. Now our grandchildren are all being homeschooled. And everywhere they go, people are like, wow, how do you have such wonderfully behaved kids, such intelligent? They talk so well. They interact so well. So I just wanted to kind of put that out there. He just, you know, also they don't realize, I think, how inexpensive it actually can be financially to homeschool. It can be done literally for as inexpensive $300 or $400 a year would buy most of the materials. There are organizations that sell everything you need already pre-done, even with parent-teacher manuals and stuff. So I just wanted to put that out there and encourage him to check it out. As a teacher, I got to tell you, I never thought I would be where I am today, but I am ready to retire soon, and I'm just sick to death of what goes on in the public schools. We ourselves, CRT, three times I've had to attend trainings and garbage. Mm-hmm. I'm a history major in particular, and
what level
I know my American
teach?
History very well.
What grade level?
Right now I'm teaching in the upper elementaries. I'm teaching fourth and fifth grade, but I'm licensed. I've taught all the way to high school, but it's shocking, the lack of knowledge. I have even some of the younger folks that I'm working with now who are coming in, new teachers, they're in their 20s, early 20s. They're completely, they don't know. They're completely devoid of true American history. And they have these attitudes because of, I would say, what I've learned is that, you know, their Marxist professors or their historians that have been teaching them things at these colleges, some of these colleges, it's just so warped. And it's sad. What's even sadder is some of them, when I will try to share information with them as colleagues or in open meetings, we'll just discuss, because, you know, we're always about planning and discussing things together. They are just, they don't want to hear it. They refuse to hear anything. Like, so as soon as they'll want to know, where'd you get information or what kind of a college? Well, if it came from like a conservative college or if it came from Boston College, let's say, or something, they don't want to hear it. And it's, you know, they're closed-minded. But
how did you make it through? If you're ready to retire and you can think clearly, yeah, which you obviously can, and you don't buy into the nonsense, which you obviously don't, how did you survive all those years? I believe you, but how did you survive?
So, you know, I first came into homeschooling. I was in the military. I was the law enforcement specialist in the Air Force, and I was overseas. And when my wife and I first started learning about homeschooling and we really got serious about our Christianity, when I came home, we just continued the homeschooling, and I went back to college. Was lucky enough to be hired by a person in a
I meant
city
in,
who
yeah,
was impressed.
I'm sorry, I meant in the public school setting.
It's not been easy. It's not been easy. You know, I've had my struggles with these people over the years, to be sure. Mm-hmm. And they continue even as we're speaking, believe me.
I'm guessing they're probably not going to throw you a big party when you retire, if they know who you are
not.
And what you're about.
What's funny is, so you ask how it is, and I will say to you that part of the reason I've been able to stay as long as I have is my scores. Everything in the state of Massachusetts is MCAS, which is their state scoring system, the annual testing and all that. And I have several times had some of the highest scores in the city. I have been observed by people from Amherst. I've had professors from even Harvard come out and videotape me.
So you're kind of protected because you produce results and they can't argue with the results, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I wish there were more teachers like you, and thank God for all those who are there who are kind of resisting. You mentioned critical race theory in passing. This is, you know, one of the things that I find curious is how many people on the left are jumping up and down and hyperventilating, trying to pretend that critical race theory is not being taught in schools, when it's self-evidently true that it is. And you said you had to go through how many workshops? You went through three workshops?
I've gone through three of these workshops so far. And what's shocking to me, sir, is that they don't call it critical race theory, of course. They call it social justice and things of that nature. But it's being taught by people, three individuals who are working for the YMCA of Rhode Island. And they're the ones presenting. And they themselves are, I don't know how, you know, where we want to go with this, but they themselves are obviously, they're openly, they're members of the LGBTQ trans community. They're openly telling you that they are transgender or they're this or that. And they start this program, each one being over an hour and a half long. And basically, you're being taught that you're being socially unjust. If you don't believe that, you are somehow automatically racist or against these sorts of sinful, messed up, corrupt beliefs, that there's something wrong with you. And I recognize it as the Marxist twist that it is. It's really bad. But yeah,
that's true. Thank you for standing up for what is right. I hope that you have an easy time of it before you retire. And thanks for all the good that you've done. And also, thank you for standing up to raise your voice on the issue of homeschooling. It's an important thing. I'm glad that there are parents like you who are willing to stand up and talk about that. Thanks for that. By the way, just as a quick aside, Seton Home Study, rather, is a friend of Relevant Radio, and we're friends of theirs. And they are perhaps the premier example that I can think of a Catholic homeschooling curriculum for all the various grades. I believe they go all the way up to grade 12. And their website is setonhome.org. You may say Seton. How do you spell that? S-E-T-O-N, name for St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, an educator. setonhome.org. We'll give you some ideas if you're homeschooling curious. Also, but while we're at it, before we take our break, one of the things that your children are, if not already indoctrinated with, they soon will be. It's a book, and it's one book among many. It's called The 1619 Project. It's more than just a book, but it's a way of engaging in revisionist history as a way to try to refashion people's understanding of American history by, in some cases, I would say, an exaggerated view of certain terrible things that have been part of American history, no doubt about it. We have a long and terrible dark chapter in this history, in American history, that involves blatant racism, of course, slavery and all the things that attended to that, which are heinous and should be condemned. And we should rightfully fight against that and do what we can to eliminate the vestiges of that terrible history. Nonetheless, there are those who are distorting that actual history, and that 1619 Project is an example of this. Now, those who are devotees of the 1619 Project, they're going to say, no, we're actually bringing you the real history. And all the people who suppressed it, for whatever reason, they may be a racist, and they don't want people to know the real history. Well, there is a scholarly, you might say, pushback against that, and it's called 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. That's by Peter Wood. Now, this is in paperback form. You can also get it on Kindle. And a little bit of the description. I would encourage you parents, especially if you want to know how to understand the bigger picture and not merely the exaggerated or the distorted version that the 1619 Project is promoting, if you want to get the other side, this book critiques the 1619 Project. So here's a bit of a description. When and where was America founded? Was it in Virginia in 1619 when a pirate ship landed a group of captive Africans at Jamestown? So asserted the New York Times in August of 2019 when it announced its 1619 Project. The Times set out to transform history by tracing American institutions, culture, and prosperity to that pirate ship and the exploitation of African Americans that followed. A controversy erupted, but the Times didn't back down. Instead, the authors ballooned their original magazine supplement into a 600-page book. Peter Wood's 1620 is a point-by-point response to the 1619 Project. He argued that the proper starting point for the American history is 1620, with the signing of the Mayflower Compact aboard ship before the pilgrims set foot in the Massachusetts wilderness. The quintessential ideas of American self-government and ordered liberty grew from the deliberate actions of those Mayflower immigrants. In this new edition of 1620, Wood brings the story up to date, including the glittering prizes for 1619 pseudo-history, the deepening disputes, and much more. So if you're interested in a resource that will help you understand the bigger picture, I would suggest that book. I have that book, by the way, 1620. All right, quick timeout. It is Taco Tuesday, so we're celebrating. And you can join the celebration by calling 888-914-9149. My name is Patrick Madrid, and I'll be right back.
Now that's what I call a taco.
One smart and simple way to get the year started with peace of mind is by creating a will. Relevant Radio has again partnered with Free Will to help make keeping this resolution easy. Using Free Will's online estate planning resources, you can create a will online in less than 20 minutes at no cost to you. Creating a will is a powerful way to protect the people, community, and causes you love while stewarding the blessings God has given you. It's absolutely free. Get started at relevantradio.com/freewill.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We do it in Mexico all the time.
We rewatched Napoleon Dynamite with some of our grandchildren. They love it.
How's it hold up?
Very well. Very well.
Oh, that's great.
We do it in Mexico all the time.
Lucky.
I can almost do that accent. As we experience the year of St. Joseph in 2021, this year we are doing something very special by spending a year celebrating Our Lady with miracles, mysteries, and Mary. We're exploring Mary's intercession in human history and in our lives every day. Grow in faith, knowledge, and devotion to Our Lady through these lessons. Miracles, Mysteries, and Mary. It's free. To receive these emails in the series and to get other exclusive content, simply sign up at relevantradio.com/Mary. That's relevantradio.com/Mary. Back to the phones. Let's go to Todd now in Madison, Wisconsin.
My question to you, Patrick, is this. I'll give you
a... Todd, forgive me. Are you on a speakerphone? Okay. We got to figure out what's going on with Todd's phone. So stand by, Todd, or call back either way. Let's go to Barbara now in Ocean Gate, New Jersey. Sorry. Are you an Ocean Gator, Barbara?
Ocean Gator, yes.
That's what they call people from Ocean Gate, isn't it?
Yeah, the Gators.
Welcome.
Ocean Gators. My question to you, somebody gave me a prayer to Mary, Undoer of Knots. And I wanted to know the origins of that and if it's recognized by the church.
It is recognized by the church at some level. It is a common novena, but I don't know without Googling it what the background is. But I'm sure if you Google Undoer of Knots novena, anything about its provenance will be available online. Do you have access to Google, Barbara?
I don't, but I can, get to it at some point.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would need to do because I don't have that info stored in my brain. But
to pray that prayer.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome, Barbara. Thank you.
Okay, God bless.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Jenny now in San Diego, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question for you regarding Mass. I was in a conversation with my mother-in-law, who's 85 years old, and she went to confessional. And in that confessional, the priest told her that it wasn't necessary for her to go to Mass every Sunday. But her concern was, well, if I don't go to Mass every Sunday, how do I actually receive the body and blood of Christ, at least on a periodic basis, rather than always watching it online or something, because you receive it in, spirit. And she was concerned about that. So what is your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that the priest said that to her, because it's simply not true. The church says that we all have a Sunday obligation. Now, that, of course, is governed by whether or not you are able to go to Mass. So somebody of advanced age or who is ill or who has a job that requires their presence on Sunday and they just can't get to Mass, or if something comes up, you have to take care of somebody like a crying or a sick baby. I mean, there are many different ways in which you would be exempt from this requirement. But if you can go to Mass, you should go to Mass, and you have an obligation under the pain of serious sin. So it would be a serious sin. Let me just add this on here for the sake of clarity. It would be a serious sin for somebody who can go to Mass and just doesn't want to, or put something else instead of going to Mass. That's a serious sin. Always has been. So in her case, you mentioned that she's 85 years old. Maybe her health is not good. She's not required to go to Mass if, due to age or infirmity, she's not able to get there. But from the standpoint of a priest telling her, you know, if what he's saying to her is, if he's discouraging her from going to Mass, that would be wrong. If he was simply acknowledging the fact that it's not easy for her to get to Mass, or it's maybe dangerous for her to go to Mass because of her health, I'm just guessing, well, then he would be right. In other words, he could tell her, in your case, in your situation, you know, it's not necessary for you to go to Mass. God understands your situation. But I'm hopeful it was some scenario like that, as opposed to him just saying, well, you know, I know you can go to Mass. I know you want to go to Mass. I know there's no problem with going to Mass, but you don't really need to go to Mass. I hope he didn't say it that way, because if he said it that way, that would be incorrect.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you so, so much.
You're welcome.
You have a good day.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, and all of us, don't forget what it was like back in the depths of COVID when you were going to Mass, so to speak, at Relevant Radio at noon central, when you would see the Mass that was simulcast. And we still do that every day, by the way. That's a very good thing to do if you're unable to get to Mass. But it's not required, number one. And furthermore, it also doesn't take the place of your Sunday obligation. So if you happen to be one of those people, and there are some out there who got really comfy with the idea of staying at home and watching Mass on the computer screen or on television and never going to Mass, well, now that the Masses are back open again, and now that the churches are back open again, and now that the Sunday obligation has been reinstated and has been for quite some time now, you have an obligation to go to Mass. So please understand that, even though you may find it more comfortable and, you know, you don't have to get in the car and go down to the church, that is not an excuse not to go to Mass. If you can go to Mass on Sunday, go to Mass on Sunday. If you, for some reason, can't, now that's different from not wanting to. If you'd rather stay home and watch Mass on TV, that's not an excuse. And I wonder how many people know that. So it's a good idea from time to time just to do a reality check. Let's go now to, we're going to go back to Todd, I think, in Madison, Wisconsin. Good morning, Todd.
Hey, Patrick. Sorry about that. Yeah, I had my speakerphone on earlier.
No problem. Much better.
My question to you is, very quickly, I was born and raised Catholic. When I got married, I wasn't taking my religion very seriously, which was in my 20s. I'm now 56, and I retired 5 years ago, and I've felt a pulling back to come back to the Catholic Church. And with that being the case, my wife is Presbyterian, and she's a deacon, and she's the best wife, mother, daughter I could have ever asked for.
That's great.
But my question is this. In our church, they celebrate communion once a month in the Presbyterian Church, which I am a member of currently. But what they do on that day, and I don't know why they chose that day, but they pick one person out of the whole congregation, and they give a witness to their faith up front about what drew them to God, what they did in their life, and how the Lord touched them. Mm-hmm. My minister asked me to do that, and without really thinking about it, a month ago, I said, yes, I would. My question to you is this. I feel in my heart that since they only celebrate communion once a month, that day should be reserved specifically for focusing on the Lord. And I've felt that these little interviews they give detracts from that. And now I want you to give like an honest opinion if you think that I'm right in that frame of thinking, or could the Lord be using me to convey a message of goodness at that time? And so I should give my little interview with the, it's about a 15 minute talk of, mm-hmm. on the day of the, so what's your take mm-hmm. on that?
This is an interesting question because your circumstances are, it's not a black and white or cut and dried situation because as a cradle Catholic, you are now in the Presbyterian Church, but you're, you know, ontologically, you're still a Catholic. Which kind of makes the situation
correct.
All the more. Yeah. So
I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead, Todd. Go ahead.
I was just going to say I never officially renounced my Catholic religion, and ever since I retired, and I've had time during the days, I've always felt the drawing to go to our Catholic church, and I go there, and I adore the beauty of it, the stained glass, the pictures of Mary and Jesus, and I say the rosary like probably four or five times a week there. Mm-hmm. So that's just another, I feel like I'm being pulled back. And so I'm kind of torn. It's kind of maybe a dumb question, but since they only celebrate the Eucharist, and that's not the Eucharist to them, you know that, it's mm-hmm. communion mm-hmm. once a month. I'm feeling tore that should I,
yeah, I think I
decline
understand.
Or should I use that time to,
I think I understand. Well, if I had to guess, Todd, just based upon what you're telling me, it sounds like you're in a state of flux right now, spiritually. And even though maybe it's not a thematic idea in your mind yet, it sounds to me as though, like you just said, the Lord is drawing you home to the Catholic Church, which is where you belong. And of course, in the Catholic Church, you would receive Jesus truly present under the appearances of bread and wine. And as you say, the Presbyterian folk, they don't believe that their communion really is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. And they're right about that because it's not. But you have something infinitely greater waiting for you at home in the Catholic Church. You have Jesus himself in the Holy Eucharist. So my first bit of advice would be follow these promptings that you're sensing, these intuitions and little nudges that you're feeling. I think it's wonderful that you're praying the rosary four or five times a week. I think it's wonderful that you're making visits to Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. And so all I would propose to you, Todd, is if you press fast forward, the goal is going to be for you to return to the Catholic Church, which is the fullness of the faith. And there you're going to receive all of those good things that Jesus wants to give you. It doesn't mean that some of them are not present in the Presbyterian Church, but the fullness of the faith is found in the Catholic Church that Christ established. So that's my heartfelt encouragement to you, would be to follow these promptings and come home. Now, in a way, if you did that, that would obviate this question about you giving the message at the Presbyterian Church, because I'm guessing they probably wouldn't want somebody getting up there and saying that I feel God drawing me home to the Catholic Church, if that's what you would say. So maybe what you can do while you're discerning these thoughts and grappling with these questions, maybe you could just take a rain check and just say, given myself, my own circumstances right now, I think it would be better if I postpone this and then maybe revisit it down the road. Now, maybe you'll wind up not ever giving that talk because, God willing, you will have come back to the Catholic Church. But, you know, it's a process. You're on a journey. I'd like to make a couple recommendations for things that can help you, Todd. And by the way, listening to this program and the rest of Relevant Radio is certainly way up there in terms of information that will help you. There's a book that I think you'll find very interesting. It's called Surprised by Truth. I edited it, so just full disclosure. But it's a compilation of 11 testimonies by people, some of whom are Presbyterian, who, for the most part, didn't like the Catholic Church. And yet they wound up becoming Catholic, but in the book they give their reasons. They explain their struggles and their questions and things. If there were one thing that I would encourage you to read, just sit down and start reading this book, it would be that book, Surprised by Truth. It has a red cover.
It's funny you say that, Patrick. Mm-hmm. I have that book. I bought it like 6 months ago after listening to you on the So I do have it. So I will start that.
Have you dipped into it yet?
But my whole thing is...
Sounds like you haven't yet.
I haven't.
Okay. Well, so here's what I would propose, Todd, and I'll throw it back to you. But maybe start reading that book as a way to help sort of help you sort through this question about whether or not to give the talk at the Presbyterian Church. I wouldn't be at all surprised if you read that book, and it's, you know, it's in chapter format, so it's not going to take a huge amount of time for any given chapter. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if by the time you're done with the book, your thinking has become very clear about how to answer this question. That's my prediction.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. My whole wrestling with it is, I mean, cause, and that brings me to the second part of my question. Is it okay for me to be a Catholic, but yet still attend with my wife? Because I don't want the division.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I completely understand.
Is that possible? Is that possible? Can you be a full-fledged Catholic, but yet still go to Presbyterian Church, just not partake in the communion?
Yes, you can. And you can do that for the sake of supporting your wife in her faith journey. Obviously, ideally, you'd like to see her united with you in the Catholic faith, and that's entirely possible. It may be that after you've read that book, Surprised by Truth, I would share that with her, because it's very likely that she's not aware of the reasons why people should become Catholic, because they've never been presented to her, so it's not her fault. But maybe she's just never heard those reasons, and perhaps after you've read the book, you can share it with her, and then the two of you can have this conversation about what's the best thing to do. Now, I'm going to be here to tell you the best thing to do is to come home to the Catholic Church. Okay. But her journey may be more complicated, but I think it would be helped by reading that book also. I really do.
Okay. I will start there, and I will call you back sometime, let you know how things are going.
I would love that. Now, Todd, before you go, it just occurred to me, there is a second book I'd like to recommend to you. And maybe, you know, I would encourage you to start with Surprised by Truth, okay? But the second book is called Evangelical is Not Enough. And it's a book written by Tom Howard, who, I, as I understand, recently died. He was a great man. He was a Presbyterian. And he taught at Gordon Conwell Seminary, just outside of Boston, for many years. And when he became a Catholic, he got fired because, you know, it wasn't good form for one of their top professors. He taught literature for him to become a Catholic. So he lost his job. But this book, Evangelical is Not Enough, is his way of explaining what drew him to the Catholic Church as a Presbyterian, and how as an
evangelical. And he was never a Catholic at the time?
Never a Catholic. No, never a Catholic. In fact, he tells an interesting anecdote. I'll leave it at this. He tells an interesting anecdote about how when he was a lad growing up, that for reasons he didn't understand at the time, every so often he would wander into a Catholic church in the neighborhood during the day, and the church was dim and empty. There was nobody there, but he could see the sanctuary light that glows red up in the sanctuary, and that candle is lit to show that Jesus is present in the tabernacle. And he describes how, as a child, he would go into the Catholic Church just out of curiosity. He had no other reason to be there. But he was aware of God's presence there in a way that he couldn't really articulate. He couldn't explain it. And only later did he discover the Eucharist, because he didn't know anything about it. But he said, even as a child, he could feel God's presence there. And eventually he came to see it was the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. So this book is very respectful. He's respectful to his Presbyterian roots. He doesn't insult anybody. He doesn't go after anybody. But he shows how his gradual awareness of the Catholic Church drew him. And I'll let him tell his story. But I think that would be another really good resource for you.
Okay. Thanks, Patrick. I will do that. And I got them both written down.
Excellent. I look forward to talking to you again, Todd. I really, 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 really do. I think you will have a whole different perspective on things when you're done reading those books. Thank you. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Cyrus, I'm going to make an executive decision here. Got another nasty gram on Twitter. I'm not even going to bother to read it. A woman yammering on about how people going to Mass on Sunday is dangerous. It's not even worthy of a response, so I'm not going to dignify it with a response.
Oh, boy.
But it just goes to show the world that some people live in. You know, they're that. Well, I think it would be piling on if I were to respond, so I won't. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Let's go to Maria now in Salt Lake City. By the way, before you say anything, Maria, Cyrus, one thing that had just occurred to me, that woman who likes to attack on social media like that, at least she's listening.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the best part about it. You know, she can't stand it, and she feels moved. She's got to, you know, spout off with stuff like that, but she's still listening. So there's hope. Maria in Salt Lake City, thank you, and welcome.
Hi. I just have a quick question for you about homeschooling.
Okay.
So is that possible, you know, if both parents work, is that something that can be done?
Well, yes. And, of course, there are maybe some creative ways to go about it. There are things called homeschool co-ops where maybe a couple times a week, a couple days a week, there are some in-class learning sessions where local homeschool families can bring their children. That happens in a lot of places. It could be something where if you had somebody to watch your children during the daytime, grandma or maybe somebody else, depending upon your circumstances, that person could be in a supervisory role. Maybe your neighbor across the street homeschools her children and would be willing to allow your child to go and be part of that curriculum. That's another possibility. So I think with creativity and flexibility, you might be able to find a way to do it. But yeah, those things are certainly possible.
And where can I go to get information about how to homeschool?
Well, I would start with one of our friends, SetonHomeStudy.org. So the Seton Home Study program is a great resource, and they've got a lot of educational videos and informational things there, so I would start there. There's also a curriculum that Nancy and I used when she was homeschooling our children, and that was called K-12. Their website is k12.com, and that's a secular...
K-12.com?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a secular homeschooling. Now, Seton is Catholic. K-12 is not Catholic, but it was started by Bill Bennett, who is the former Secretary of Education. He's a Catholic, and he's certainly very Catholic-friendly. So the curriculum is very Catholic-friendly, but just keep in mind that it's secular. But it is one of the nice things about K-12 is that it's free. So the books, the computers, the printers, art supplies, that's all free because it makes use of the money that you pay in taxes that if you're homeschooling, would go to the local school district. But that's another option. Okay. And some families use a hybrid where they'll use more than one curriculum. So there are a variety of ways you can go about it. But I would definitely start with Seton Home Study and maybe start from there.
Okay, sounds good. I've written it down. So thank you so much.
Good. You're most welcome. Great to talk to you. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
You're welcome. 888-914-9149. How about Katrina now in Georgetown? Hello, Katrina.
Oh, hello, Patrick. What a perfect segue, because my children do one of the hybrid schools that you were talking about.
Oh, very good. How does that work out?
Yes, it's fantastic. And I actually work in the pro-life industry, so it allows me to work part-time doing pro-life work, and they're able to, it's kind of a funny story. I was one of the moms that was never open to homeschooling. Mm-hmm. For me, I always thought it was fantastic for all the other moms and thought they were superheroes. But we were, up until my oldest daughter, I have four daughters, up until my oldest daughter was in seventh grade, we were in a full-time Catholic school. And we were originally in a school in Orlando called Holy Family. And then we moved here to Austin, and they attended a school in Georgetown full-time. And for various reasons, it was placed on my heart out of nowhere, honestly. I wasn't even remotely open to any form of homeschooling for myself. I just didn't think it was for me, you know, for my kids. And for various reasons, it was placed on my heart. And then there were some things that were kind of going on at the school that we weren't pleased with, and this and that. And I remember when I brought it up to my husband, who is in the tech industry and travels for work quite a bit, and or was at the time, and he thought I was crazy because we had four children. We had left all of our support system in Florida, moved to Texas. We're starting kind of all over, you know. And we prayed a novena. We kept praying about it, and it just felt like the thing that we were supposed to do. So we finally decided to do it, try it for 1 year and see how it went and then go from there. And here we are 6 years later.
Oh, that's great.
So, and it hasn't been easy. We do a classical school. And so it's a really good education. I mean, they do a lot of, you know, they're really good novels. And my eighth grader just read Quo Vadis. Mm-hmm. And she's reading Macbeth right now.
That's
and
great.
So it's fantastic. And it's hard, right, Patrick? So I feel like, I mean, there are many days when I just want to throw in the cards, because as a homeschooled mom, with the hybrid, they have teachers 2 days a week. So they go Tuesdays and Thursdays, and they go all day, and they have teachers. And so when they're home, they don't really look at me as a teacher. I'm more of a facilitator. I answer questions. I'm kind of the driver to make sure they're doing their work, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there are days when, you know, they're not doing the work they're supposed to be doing, or they're not staying on top of it. And there's, you know, there's definitely challenges, right, with any type of school. But, you know, I love that they're getting a Catholic education still. And
that's
I love
great.
That they are, you know, able to go to school 2 days a week. So they get kind of the best of both worlds.
And I'll bet your children are all the happier because mom's energized and excited about it, as opposed to like, oh boy, I got a homeschool. The fact that you're into it and that you see the value, I would think that would be contagious for your kids, right?
Yeah, it is. I think that the hard thing would be just, you know, the days that you have, and I feel like you're going to have these days no matter how you school your kids, honestly, because when you do full-time school, they come home and have homework regardless. And you still have to get all that, you know, you still as a parent have to facilitate that. And so we're really praying on our oldest graduated. She's discerning colleges right now. She's will be going off to college in the fall. And and our other three, our number two, will be starting high school next year. And so we're really praying about, do we continue doing this, what we're doing, or do
how
we do a full-time
that,
Catholic school?
Your older daughter, how old did you say she is?
So she's 18.
Oh.
So I have an 18-year-old and then a 14-year-old, and then I have identical twins that are 12.
Okay, this sounds like a busy household. Here's why I ask that, and I have to run, but Christendom College, good friends of the network, and I really love Christendom College, and I never miss an opportunity to promote what they do. They and their website, by the way, is christendom.edu, but they have a summer program for students just like your daughter, and it's called The Best Summer Ever. And I know that I believe that they are still accepting registrations for students who'd like to go. So if you were to go to christendom.edu, if you're interested, take a look at the Best Summer Ever program. That might be something for your daughter to go experience. And that would give her another window into Christendom, if that's the college that she might be interested in.
Yeah, I've heard great things about that school. I think I actually met one of somebody from that school at a pro-life women's conference I went to last year in Memphis last summer.
Yeah.
I've heard fantastic things, so thanks for the reminder. I'll definitely check it out.
You're welcome. Well, great talking to you, Katrina, and I'm happy for your kids that they've got such an engaged and enthusiastic mom. That's awesome. Thank you. Let's go to, let me think here, let's go to Josh in Forest Hill, California. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Patrick. First-time caller. Thank you for your time. I have a quick question revolving around Catholic apologetics.
Sure.
It was recently part of a discussion involving the synod and synodality, revolving around the multiplication of loaves and fishes, and great, loving discussion amongst multiple denominations. But, of course, being the the Catholic in the group, there were some very pointy questions revolving around repetitive prayer and mm-hmm. our intercession to the saints and, of course, our love of Mary. I know you're a heck of an author. I just didn't know if you had any resources with regard to books and or podcasts that you could refer me to better my skills. That's really not a matter of being right or wrong, but if I were to give myself a grade, it was more of like a C+ in my responses. I'd just like to be better equipped right. in the future.
You want to become an A student. I totally understand it. The first thing I would suggest would be there's a ton of information that's available at Catholic Answers. I used to work there for 8 years, long, long ago. But their website is catholic.com, and they've got just a myriad of articles and tracts and other resources. For my part, I teach apologetics at a couple of different institutions. The one that might be most interesting to you is Holy Apostles College and Seminary. Their website is holyapostles.edu. So if you go to holyapostles.edu/Patrick, you can see the apologetics course that I teach to undergraduates and graduate students. And that might be another step in the direction that you want to go in terms of getting a formal training. And continue the conversation. And speaking of which, I will be back in conversation with you again tomorrow. And between now and then, I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.